27, the parole board. Every member has had the committee substitute for several days now, 4 days. Are there any suggested changes, amendments, or deletions that we haven't discussed previously or have been decided upon by the committee? Mr. Anderson?
Chairman, just for the sake of discussion, if members of the committee promise not to follow in a faint on the committee substitute for Senate Bill 327 Judiciary, compensation at the top of the board, I'd like to try for $150 a day.
Is there any discussion of Mr. Anderson's motion?
I oppose it in this time of
Austerity.
Austerity is, I can't see even these guys, and they should do it out of love of state. In fact, they should donate their time.
Well, your position is very clear, Senator Ray. Tongue in cheek, notwithstanding.
I just asked for the same discussion.
I concur in your suggestion. The amount that's in the statute has been there for some time. They spend a considerable amount of time per year, and I would like to see them send it for them to attend meetings and attend to the business of the state, because all we need is an unfortunate decision or something else to happen in the process, and I think that's guarded against by having maximum participation. Great deal of faith in the parole board, but I want to give them every incentive, because they do put a tremendous amount of time in.
Mr. Chairman, that cost of living deal in Anchorage looks better and better.
Senator Ray, at least if the chairman could have ever figured out how it worked.
I think they get $4 a day more.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move for $150 a day.
Mr. Anderson has moved an amendment striking 100 and adding 150, page 3, line 1.
I object.
Objection by Senator Ray. Senator Bartlett, do you have any?
No comments.
All those in favor of the amendment, raise your right hand. All those opposed, raise your right hand. The amendment passes. Is there any other discussion of Senate Bill 327? Certainly, we spent a great deal of time on this bill.
I'm sorry. I'll withdraw that question.
And is also entitled to per diem besides $100 per day?
Mr. Chairman.
$150 a day?
That's the normal operating procedure for commissions of this sort.
It is?
That's fine. Since one of the times I remember you sent one across to us, there was a break.
I never.
Since it was put on the ABC board.
No. To the per diem?
I think most boards and commissions do operate on that.
Yes.
You mean you get $150 plus per diem?
Plus per diem.
So you're talking about $200 and some dollars a day?
Depending on where.
They're out of town. How do you get on there?
Which end of the process would you like to become involved in, Senator?
Well, I think they're involved in both of them, except they don't wear a mask and a gun. So what's the committee's, what's your motion, Mr. Chairman?
I believe Senator Farr was going to.
I withdrew or sent away a question.
I've had an answer.
I can move past the bill and read the recommendation.
Senator Farr has moved to pass Senate Bill 327 from committee with individual recommendations. Is there any opposition? If there's no opposition to that motion, Senate Bill 327 is passed from committee with individual recommendations.
We're going to get $1,000.
I've never heard of any per diem plus $125.
That's going to make us look.
putting no rec on because I might have one or two amendments.
Is that to keep the parole board in jail?
No.
I understand your concerns out of it.
I never heard of anybody getting that fuss of that.
Yeah, they're
board of fish, they get board of game.
Any one of the number of commissions receive
Too many complaints about the board of fish spending so much time in there, you know. All they gotta do is cut down on the per diem or cut down on their compensation and they end up the time of life. Here we're talking about putting 120-day sessions on these guys on us and giving these guys incentive to stay.
I just wrote my column today on why it's a few short sessions aren't too good.
Oh boy, you're coming around, huh?
It's 20.
One thing it's fair to ask or confirm is that I have never yet been able to uphold a legislature versus a governor.
Is he some kind of expert in that field?
What about you?
I've done everything I can for everybody.
I know you.
I'm all things to all people.
Remember my good little bill about withdrawing confirmations?
Oh, yes.
He loved it. Yeah.
You remember when you saw the Dillingham Airport and the Geno Bridge?
No. Yes.
Next, I'd like to
a mirage.
To take up Senate Bill 864, the Alaskan Code Revision Commission, the timely bill, since we're discussing the matter on the floor today.
You can hold that bill until it gets through.
To give members of the committee some background, Mr. Gardner and myself were involved in the original drafting of the bill. I think it was perhaps Senator Rader, who was one of the earliest proponents. The Code Revision Commission has its other. Code Revision Commission is like commissions in other states.
This is the language. Members who are not state employees or legislators are entitled to receive the standard per diem and travel allowance provided for members of the board of the commission. Standard. And
Mr. Bruce, could you go through the language? This language was essentially language that was developed in a House Judiciary Committee hearing this year with members of the Code Revision Commission. And I think it makes some changes and some good changes in the language, and would ensure an expeditious treatment of the bill.
Yeah, do you want me to
please
do both the House Judiciary version and the Senate State Affairs, or
the? The Senate State Affairs brought forth a bill that said the Code Commission could only do work if the legislature passed a concurrent resolution directing them to do a specific piece of work. Which,
what, Mr. Chairman, what is the reason? Why are you increasing the bill size?
Well, the
I think that this was the House motion, and I'll give you my reason. But I'd like to hear what the House rationale was.
Well, I sat in on the House hearings, and the rationale for increasing the commission and adding the new public members was because they thought that the commission was weighted with government employees and didn't have enough input from the public.
The other reason, Senator, is the public members often have other things to do, and whether they're from the court system or whether they're from the legislature system, myself, you can't attend all the meetings. And as a consequence, the public members provide the private members provide a much better quorum. The two private members are certainly the most active members of the commission, Stroud and Mr. Kurtz. And it does help provide a quorum. I think we have to assume there will be several commissioners missing at any one meeting because of whatever obligations they have.
And Mr. Chairman, why are we putting the council in here? You're going to be doing review work for the legislative council?
Well, this would be just to review and consider proposals, and the legislative council was included along with the other designated people who can give suggestions.
What, in response to your question, Senator Ray, if, just to make it clear that if the legislative council wishes the code commission to take a look at something, that they have every statutory right to do that, even though they do now, as far as I'm concerned, because of course the code commission comes beneath the legislature. It was, that's, I think, just cleanup language. Is, as you know, we've dealt with them on council, a long time member of council.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I might ask you a question. Do they hire an attorney who actually does the actual work on writing and so forth, or several attorneys?
Several.
Yeah. If that being the case, is any special reason that we need a block of attorneys on this commission? It would appear to me that they're going to hire the, in a sense, technical expertise. The membership of the commission really should not be attorneys primarily, and because they're going to hire that expertise for the actual legal side of it. I guess what makes it desirable to increase the number of public members, but maybe you ought to specify that the two legislators cannot be attorneys, or else take out the person from the Bar Association.
I would recommend take the guy out of the Alaska Bar Association. What is he doing over there?
The bar has an ongoing program in various areas of the law and can provide input and actually provide communication with proposed changes. I think you're
not being anti-attorney, Mr. Chairman. It's just that if they're going to have the attorneys who will do the legal thing, if they're going to come in with what might be called policy legislation, if that's what they're going to be doing, then, you know, it should be primarily non-attorney members. If they're going to come in with a highly technical legal language, perhaps a revision of some rather abstruse parts of the commercial code, that's a different story. It depends what their main purpose is.
The work is almost about 70% technical. For example, the Recording Act, which spent a great deal of time on, they put out, and because the administration finally spent some time on it, has sent back to the Code Revision Commission. Would be incorrect to say there's no policy decision, because of course there's any policy. There are always policy decisions in law, but they tend to be legal policy decisions rather than pure public policy. And the commission has tried to stay away from areas that the legislature is involved in, or wishes to do, or can be done by some other agency. The corporation codes, recording documents, State Exemptions Act, which of course for judgments, areas that few other, if any other group would be interested in dealing with at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned the Exemptions Act, for example, that if they're going to be dealing with technical legal matters, that is not one of them. That's purely and simply a matter of policy decided by the legislature. And whereas most of us who are not attorneys are kind of lost in some of the other things, like the bill we had this year on the
recording.
No, not that one. That had policy and a lot of policy. Yes. Two of the other one on the, I think it was last on the the business of security interests and
UCC.
That's where they've been most useful, you know, and not in other things that the average non-attorney legislator can understand.
Well, I don't have anything against the commission, and I don't know if this was previous to your membership on there or not, Mr. Chairman, but I know that they, when we were considering the codification of the Title IV, they hired somebody to bring up a version of it, and it was almost pathetic.
Wasn't as good as your version, I understand.
No, it was just pathetic. I mean, the guy didn't understand it, and he made some recommendations I couldn't even believe. And thankfully, the other members of the commission took a look at his work and said, get out.
The commission was also very sensitive about the fact that it didn't want to be working in an area. Everybody realized the need for it, and the commission did take did take that task. But when it became apparent that there was other work being done, the commission pulled away from that. Yes, that's right.
I see. Very good judgment. And you're sensitive. The people on the commission were sensitive to that, and I appreciate that.
With regard to the membership, the three public members may or may not be attorneys. They may have any profession. My preference is to keep it at public members, and those people that are involved, if they're really concerned and interested, then they should be appointed. They make the best commission members.
Is Billy Berry a member of this, or is he just an
No, he's ex officio because of his position with legislative affairs.
Well, do you have all your questions answered, Senator?
I guess so, Senator. Yeah.
I mean, I knew we just been talking, so. Well,
I really haven't been all that impressed by the Court of Vision Commission. Frankly, I have nothing against them, but from the time I've been here, I really haven't seen a great product. That's why I was wondering how many lawyers they were hiring and so forth. People working, you know, in a sense, just as volunteers and getting per diem, you know. That's one thing, but if you got several people working full time, you ought to get some more of a product than I've seen just yet.
The commission is at fault for not tooting its horn anymore. The best work they've done has been in specialized area corporations, for example, with utilized Professor Fessler from University of California. He's a very well known authority in the area. The commission spends a great deal of time on uniform acts to ensure that they conform with the Alaska statutes. We've passed several of those.
I'd move the committee substitute, Mr. Chair.
Is there any objection to the adoption of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 864? If not, if not, the committee substitute adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to propose possible amendment to see what you as a member of the commission think. Page 2, line 19. This, I presume, are the duties of the commission, but I can look it up at this moment. I'm not sure whether it comes down. I would like to look at the statute. I'm not sure if you want to do that, but I'd like to make to have it so that a requirement that proposed statutory changes submitted by the commission shall be accompanied by a bill analysis written for non-attorney members of the legislature. One of my big concerns, we had one and it was so confusing before, and it was very, very difficult to get any sort of solid answers when we got to get to the committee table. And you know, after all, the present legislature, we have how many attorneys?
Two in the House and two in the Senate.
Brown, and then we've got four. I mean, 56 of us are not attorneys. And it appeared to me that this would be a requirement, if it didn't already in statute, that every bill submitted would be accompanied by an analysis explaining the proposed legislation and terms understandable by non-attorney members. And the wording of that I'm open on. I don't think that's sensitive.
I certainly have no objection to that. I think it's a good idea. There's been suggested that with you know, every bill that actually goes to the floor, that conceptual analysis be done. And it's not a value. Mr. Bruce, could you pass me the statute stipulation to the Code Commission?
I don't think there's an unreasonable requirement. I don't know what portions are going to be, or maybe six attorneys next time or something else, 60. Probably will, like in recent years, we continue to be a small minority of attorneys.
Actually, the amendment could be done in 2420.075. That would be.
Well, I assume that C2 would be the duties.
Right. And it would be. See if we can agree upon some language now and have Mr. Bruce.
I was giving you I wouldn't find your exact wording. I'd be willing to buy any wording that just said essentially what I'm assuming.
My suggestion would be to agree with the committee in under I to state that accompanying each proposed bill shall be a sectional analysis.
Understandable by non-attorney legislature.
Sectional analysis. Intended for lay members of the legislature. Is there any objection to Senator Barr's proposed amendment? If there is no objection to the proposed amendment, the amendment is adopted. Please substitute.
Mr. Chairman, Section 4 here, I don't like the last new language. I don't think it's within the purview of a interim committee or a committee such as a composition is to be able to appoint any person. If you're going to have the work, I think it should remain within the committee itself, and they can have expert witnesses come in and testify, and they have the funds to pay them for their testimony, and have to appoint subcommissions of any person. I don't believe in that. I mean, no.
Mr. Bruce, was that language discussed at the House?
Yeah, it was. The rationale behind it was just that if there was a very narrow area of the law that there wasn't much expertise in, but one or two individuals, and they could go to that person and see if they would be willing to serve on a subcommission for a particular point of law.
Yeah. You can hire them as expert witnesses or something like that.
The idea was to try and get people who might be willing to spend some time on that were experts in an area without actually having to pay them.
And then the expert is just worth just what he's paid, isn't it? I don't believe that your commission should be able to appoint subcommissions from any person. If you want to make subcommissions between them and the commission itself, that's fine. But any person? Will we run around with 10 or 12 subcommittees of anybody?
Well, the idea is, of course, to pull those people who are experts in a certain area of the law. For example, in the area of the ABC, if language had been in existence at that time, it might have been possible to overcome some of the problems of not having people that were really expert in that point of law, such as yourself, involved in the process. And that's the strong point. But I understand your concern.
I think that you can find another way than by appointing subcommissions to that. That's just more the way I feel about it, and I would move to strike the new language.
I have no strong feelings about it one way or the other. I think it'll make the work a little bit better, but no doubt. Fine. How do the other members feel about that language?
Senator Ray has strong feelings about it, I'll concur.
I just don't like the idea of branching out to the subcommissions. Any person.
The If there's no objection, Senator Ray's motion, then we'll strike section 4 on page 2, line 20.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I understand that it's a possible source of embarrassment sometimes when you find commissions that the legislature has never dreamt of.
Well, it is. And all of a sudden, there comes something floating through.
I understand your concern. Are there any other questions or comments on Senate Bill 864?
If there are no other questions, Mr. Chairman, I move it out with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to the motion to pass Senate Bill 864 from committee with individual recommendations? If not, the bill is passed from committee with individual recommendations. Next, I'd like to take up Senate Bill 377, or rather House Bill 377, forgiving debts owed by political subdivisions for judicial services. This is a topic that we've dealt with before.
What's the number?
House Bill 377. Well, we dealt with House Bill 377 in the amendment that Senator Fisher made to Senate Bill 535.
Race, race, color, and creed.
And we have been requested. So 377 was sort of an open vehicle for another bill.
I'll not be a party to using things like that to change the title and change the subject. I won't. It's not germane, and I don't know why you should do it.
Who's here to speak on behalf of the department?
This is Patrick Anderson from the Municipality of Anchorage is here on this today.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I received a request from the municipality's legal department to ask the legislature to forgive a certain debt that the state of Ledges was incurred between approximately January of 1975 and June of 1976. And the memorandum that you have is a request from the Richard Waller, Assistant Municipal Attorney. In terms of background of the litigation itself, I can't give you any of that, because I have not seen it. It has apparently been in the court system since 1978. In 1977, House Bill 214 did pass forgiving the debt, which was vetoed by the governor. At the time, the municipal law department in the municipality had understood through the attorney's office that the governor would allow passage of that. At the present time, they have said again, let us see if we can get legislation forgiving this debt, in which case the state will be very happy to dismiss the lawsuit. Senator Parr, well, I believe everybody here was a member of the legislature when we passed the original bill that forgave services. And this is, Mr. Anderson, is it correct to characterize this as a bit of a glitch in the system where...
Something broke down between the Attorney General's office and the governor that year. And I'm not sure exactly where it did. I think it's a good characterization of what happened. The state has been... understanding that they feel they have an obligation to press the litigation unless there is some legislation forgiving. Obviously, they'd be subject to criticism from some quarters if they unilaterally made that decision.
The long and the short of it is that there's almost a year's period there, perhaps not quite that much, that was not covered by the legislation that was passed to cover judicial services at that time, and the bill would do that. Senator Ray, you have an objection to using a House bill?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. This is a short-circuiting of the system, and it's one that I have long opposed, and I can't remember ever using this vehicle, although it was used many times by various members. And we had a problem with it last year in which we had a rules change, and the rules change would have been effective if it...
Okay.
effective as of...
It will be effective, and I just don't believe in using this kind of vehicle, that's all. If it's that important a bill, and it's that satisfactory, I'm sure that they could go through the normal term. You could put the bill in and by the Judiciary Committee, and you could pass it out, and it would pass and then go to the House and have them make their whatever committee structure is there. Bad deal.
Yeah,
the idea is fine. I don't object to the idea at all. But I just don't like using it. Because it opens up so many other doors. You say, well, we can just use it for this because it doesn't have too much. But I made quite a deal out of Germanius last year.
I remember you and I have discussed it for several years. Is there a similar feeling on behalf of other members of the committee with regard to using a House bill that has in effect had the language in it already passed and is available for... I don't think anybody has probably a great deal of difficulty with the content. It's the form in this case.
Mr. Chairman, I'm voting yes to approve changes. I guess my position is already established.
Mr. Anderson, how do you feel about
the
process?
I think the rule changes that occurred in my absence were a mistake, because I think the public is inserting themselves in areas where they don't belong, taking away the legislative prerogative. Really care too much about rules changes.
This is an efficient method of doing it, but I want to be very, very upfront and
I have no objection to stripping somebody else's bill and putting
something. Chairman, it's a clear violation of the existing rules in the Mason's manual. You cannot do it under the existing rules. And if you want to do it, then two things.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to stripping a bill and putting something else in its place.
It's a violation of the
existing rules. I agree with you, Senator.
It is a violation of the existing rules. To supplement the existing rules. It's a clear violation.
Let me check with, quite frankly, I'd like to check with the chair, because the chair determines that, check with Mr. Barrier as well, and see what the pleasure of the chair is. It is an efficient way to do our business, and it is an item that will not be... not be criticized because of content, but I want to make sure the actual format
Chairman,
will work.
In order to expedite the business, I'd like to move the bill pending the chair's decision.
Fine. Mr. Anderson, move the bill pending the decision of the chair, and I'll talk to Senator.
I'll have to object.
Okay. All those in favor of moving the bill from committee, raise your hand. All those opposed to passing the bill from committee. The bill would pass from committee pending the decision of the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. There, why don't we hold that until
do not pass, violation of the usual rules.
Do not collect $200 and not pass go.
I'm not opposed to the concept, though, because you know how strong I feel about that.
One other bill we don't have before us because the committee copy hasn't been done.
Oh, we just got.
We get in trouble.
We just got to go through, sir.
We get in trouble.
Just to be science. Get out here so I can vote.
I'd like to bring up this time Senate Bill 686. Mr. Conkety, could you join us?
We have to get the Rubik Cube out again?
Hey, right.
This is not a Rubik Cube bill.
No.
This is providing a property that the problem is that when property is recovered pursuant to a robbery or burglary, it's needed for the trial, and the person, even if the burglar or robber is caught, is often deprived of their property for lengthy periods of time, and this bill is intended to solve that problem somewhat by providing for a procedure by which the property can be cataloged and can be used as evidence in trial, but the property can actually go back to the person from whom it was stolen.
Mr. Chairman, I've had personal experience with that. We had our store burglarized, and it took months to get the stuff back. You can't get it back. It's sitting there, locked up in somebody's property room. And it doesn't work the hardship.
That's true.
Derek. Mr. Conn, how do you have that?
There are some situations where, of course, that will still occur. I mean, we're not automatically tying in with this legislation to a situation where this property is automatically returned or mandated on returns, because oftentimes property is absolutely necessary. For example, in those situations where value is in question, you have to have the property there. Those situations where the property stolen is used in a crime as opposed to the prosecution of a crime for stolen property, for example, a handgun or a weapon. In those situations,
you're making it tough here.
If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I'll explain the changes in the bill.
Proceed.
Basically, Section 1 of the bill amends existing law. The language that is contained there is a rewrite of what is presently in the court rules, and it conforms Chapter 35 of Title 12 to the practices that are presently occurring. The impression one gets when reading Chapter 35 is that the property is turned over to a judge or magistrate, and that is just not the case. The property is inventoried, as it states out here in B, C, and D, and this is the manner in which it's done. It's a conforming amendment, conforming the law to the court rules and to the practices that our police departments are presently using in the state. Chapter 36 is a new chapter in the law, and it handles the disposition of all types of property that we get. It includes, it allows in Section 020 for the return of property automatically under certain situations. In 030, what happens when the property is unclaimed.
Can I stop you there for a second?
Certainly.
Send a radio for
Mr. Chairman, as long as this photographic evidence of a property is acceptable, why can't that be used? Why shouldn't that be used, except in the cases of course, substances? and just ordinary property or something. Why couldn't they just take pictures and return the property to the guy?
You mean mandate just taking the property and returning it? There are two or three different types of cases, situations where that would not be feasible. One is a question of value. For example, under the current law, we have a cutoff of, we'll say, $500, which it is between a C felony and an A misdemeanor theft crime. If you have a piece of property whose value is in that marginal range, if it's something like, we'll say, a fancy color television set, that is a question of fact that has to be determined by the jury. And in those type of situations, we wouldn't want to use it. Similarly, there's a case, White v. State, whereby the court has admonished the prosecution on returning of certain types of property if there is a chance that that property could in any way be exculpatory to the defendant. For example, we recover a television set again from the trunk of someone's car and take a photograph of it and return it to the person. The person could, and we prosecute the person who owned the car, and he sits there and says, well, I didn't even know it was there. And if you would have taken fingerprints off of that.
You're down another track, or I am. What I'm saying is, like in Charlie's, where they took stuff as evidence and held it for how long?
4 or 5.
They recovered the evidence. Why didn't they take the pictures of it and return the evidence to him? You get the pictures of it, and you use those in court.
That's what we're doing.
Is that what it does say here?
That's what it says eventually on page 4 of the bill.
All right.
Photographic evidence of property wrongfully taken or damaged.
All right. Okay.
I mean, there are some situations where that just won't do, though. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
That you can't do it in every situation.
Okay.
But it should account for a vast majority, 80 or 90%.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
Which is
right.
What we're trying to do is make the public that's been the victim of a crime at least made as whole as we can by law, not a double penalty.
Yeah.
Sections 030.
Of course, if it goes up in smoke. The contraband.
Oh, that. Sections 030 and 040 of the bill address a problem that is wanting in current law, and that is that we have property that has been seized or has come into the possession of law enforcement agencies, and we do not have the power under the law to rid ourselves of it. We've got evidence lockers full of stuff, and we just don't know what to do with it. Can't do anything with it.
So that's what 030 and 040 do.
Yeah.
And of course, section 3 is photographic evidence of property.
Yeah, we have a brief Senator Ray's making jokes. I'm going to break up this interview.
Tilt
time. He commented on an unofficial means of solving a problem. I don't think he wants to repeat it, though.
I don't care.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Connetti.
And finally, section 3 of the bill, 1280050, is the a new provision in law, and it models an act in Kansas, which they enacted a couple years ago, which is about the only state other than California which has a scheme for using photographs instead of evidence. And it essentially changes the court rule, so of course we'll need a two-thirds vote on that, but it permits photographs of the evidence to be competent evidence in lieu of the real property itself in that situation.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parr.
Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate, maybe it wouldn't be, but maybe the court wouldn't like it, but would it be appropriate to put in a provision that would direct an attempt to get a stipulation from both the defense and the prosecution on the value of items, to meet what Mr. Conhetti was saying about this television set that's on the boundary between the Class A misdemeanor and the Class C felony? Because, you know, if that's going to be a case, it's going to cause, and where a photograph doesn't show you what the thing is worth, right? Would there be any objection to trying this stipulation route, that both defense and prosecution have stipulated the value of
that? That would work in the absence of any language that would allow it to be done.
That's what we're trying to do now.
The rub comes in when the value is disputed, and anything we write in the law will not solve that, unfortunately.
Well, I know, as I said, that the court would attempt to get stipulations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not saying that. The defense attorney may say, I will not stipulate this is worth $501, but then my client can be accused of, I understand that. But,
right.
But the stipulations are, they do attempt to get those
numbers. Oh, we do that frequently now.
Well, I didn't know.
Both with value and with just the fact that this is the property itself. This more or less mandates an ability on our part allows us to go ahead without the stipulation situation.
Well,
when it's very clear.
Your photographs in section 3 now,
mm-hmm.
They won't show that value. I mean, you can take, for example, my hometown, they call Ivory Jack, had his collection stolen, right? It's in the paper here recently. Pretty well ruined, but you know, I don't know how a photograph is going to show really the valuation of that property.
It wouldn't.
There's no way at all it's going to do it.
There will be items that would be very difficult to photograph.
Would section 3 make an exception for that, where you have the problem of valuation?
No, it just says that section 3 just allows, I mean, essentially it says that the photographed evidence is competent evidence. It's the same as introducing the evidence itself. On the question of value, that would have to be within the discretion of the prosecuting attorney to sit there and say, well, there's no way we're going to be able to prove value over $500.
You seem to say that was a major point. You seem to say the valuation is one of the major concerns about getting the property back to the people.
It's not a major concern, but I mean, it is one of the concerns there that we have. I mean, that no matter what we do, there's no way we can get around that.
When there is a problem that if 10% of the cases are problems, that valuation is probably going to be a problem at least half of those cases,
mm-hmm.
because it will mean the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony in many cases, which is a very important distinction.
Right. This is really justice. You have a juvenile breaks into your house, carries your stuff off. You call up. You don't know it's a juvenile, you just call up and report a burglary, and the police recover it and find out it's a juvenile. You don't get the name of the juvenile, and nobody will release the name to you who took your stuff. They got it in custody, and they could put the juvenile in McLaughlin Youth Center for 3 years, keep your property, till 6 months after the final disposition of the case, till 6 months after he's released.
It's not 6 months after he's released.
Within 6 months after the final disposition of the case, It could be that long by the time they found who you were. Again, you could have forgot about it in 4 years.
Oh, that's... That could be
that's
a problem,
justice.
Too.
I've got here a whole new yeah. system.
No, you're correct. The final disposition in juvenile adjudication is very difficult to determine sometimes.
Yeah. That's the only... I don't see it possible. You don't even know who ripped you off.
If Senator Fisher saw fit to pass a bill from his committee that we introduced and is residing there with a leaden bottom.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Parr.
I didn't understand that the problem that Senator Ray just raised, and apparently it is from Mr. Conde, and you agreed to, I guess. Couldn't that wording on page 2, line 23 be changed?
Redefined.
I didn't realize the final disposition of the case for a juvenile didn't happen until after you reached age 19.
That's not what we're referring to.
What we're talking about, the final disposition of the case should be after the appeals have been taken, I suppose. I don't know.
What if the kid's 14 years of age?
Well, I don't know. I'm just asking the question. Do we really have a problem caused by juveniles? Maybe we ought to straighten it out right here.
Proceedings. We just defined final disposition of the case in here in section 090 on page 3. Well, say exactly what you were talking about, Senator Parker.
Yeah. Well, then what's Senator Ray's concern? I don't understand.
I don't know
so much
about juveniles.
What
is the final disposition?
There's two problems. One is that it's the person who had their property stolen would not necessarily know who the individual was or when the final disposition was. Yeah. It's very difficult to find out. That's a problem. Secondly, there are different kind of treatments for juvenile offenders as is appropriate. I think we'd all agree with that. But sometimes it's very difficult to tell when the final disposition of that case is, when you'll have a juvenile that has to again appear or is a...
What's the percentage of cases, Mr. Chairman, when juveniles are involved in robbery cases where property is taken? What, 70% of it is done by juveniles?
Mr. Bruce, could you...
Well, 70% of it, here's guys standing around for years and saying, what happened? Who did it? Who took it? Where is it?
Mr. Chairman, is there any reason not, under the definitions on page 3, to prescribe... To prescribe the what happens as far as the juvenile is concerned, if there is a difference there, foundation of the case means what's here in juvenile cases. It means so forth, and you get it laid out because when the conviction is entered, or I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what the right wording is, but what's the objection to doing that?
However, in cases involving a juvenile. State assumes custody of the juvenile when the property.
They don't always assume custody is the problem.
Who does?
Do you have a suggestion?
Well, I was just. The juvenile proceedings can be appealed as well as any criminal proceedings. So I guess I'm unsure why this is an insufficient definition.
Well, let me ask you a question. Suppose what the chairman was saying was something about the juveniles that treated differently than the adults in the sense that all I'm saying is if that's the case, then why don't we do something to cover that?
There is a problem with the right to know the disposition of a juvenile within the juvenile justice system.
Why don't you take this back and bring it back on Wednesday and bring us back the answer on that?
The answer is contained. Do you want to know what the final dispositions of juvenile cases?
So if we have to do something, we can
certainly
put some kind of language.
Well, let me direct your attention to subsection C on page 2 of 020, which directs the law enforcement agency who are aware of what's going on to return the property to the known owners within 6 months of that final disposition.
The
question is final disposition.
There you go.
That's what I'm saying.
That's the cracker.
Okay. If something isn't.
All right.
And if we have to maybe in the definition section show it.
Redefine final disposition for a juvenile proceeding.
Something like
we
that.
Will do that.
Okay.
And Mr. Bruce, you have a question?
No, I understand.
Senator Ray, please do not bait the staff during the committee meeting.
Please do not growl at the staff.
Could I do it after the meeting?
Of course.
May I go?
Am I excused, Mr. Chairman?
Are there any other questions for Mr. Conhetti? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Conhetti. I think we do have a provision. Fine. Mr. Magnuson?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Don Magnuson with the Alaska Retail Association. I just wanted to state that the association wholeheartedly supports the section regarding photographic evidence. As Senator Parr has mentioned, it can be extremely costly for a retailer to have to wait several months or even years to for the return of a portion of his inventory, which has been taken in burglary or robbery. I was questioning about it. In Section B, there is provision for a written description of the property to accompany the photograph. I was wondering if possibly in those areas where there is a question of value, if in the case of robbery of a retail establishment, if the indicated retail price could be established as value and entered on the record at that point. And in the case of other goods stolen from an individual, for example, an expert could be called upon to testify to approximate value of property and enter it in the record.
It's a very difficult thing too, because the court makes the decision with regard to value, despite what a retail or value price. Mr. Conhetti, do you have any comments?
We looked specifically at that question, and it was our feeling that in those situations where we did return the property, we would still a written description or an appraisal even would not be sufficient. But what we would do would be we'll bring in Joe's store owner or somebody who would sit there and say, yes, this is the property that was taken. I was there, I saw it recovered, or they brought it back to me, and I have these invoices, the property is worth X amount of dollars. That person would still have to come back into court and testify to that whole situation.
What's your deal here on page one there, where you say, or shall leave the copies and the receipt at the place from which the property was taken? I mean, just nail them to the door or what?
That's if you execute a search warrant on a place that is just, it is nobody's home at. If you haven't got anybody to give it to.
And you see something?
And you see something.
Then what do you do? Just leave the copies there?
Yes.
Nailed to the wall, literally.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
That's fairly old law. It goes back a long ways.
I really didn't know. I don't know how they do that. Huh.
So when you get home tonight.
The burglars don't leave those, by the way.
Done?
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Conhetti will return for return engagement before the committee on Wednesday regarding this bill. Is there any other matter to come before the Judiciary Committee? If not, Judiciary Committee is adjourned.